So thank you for the opportunity of being here. It's always delightful to be here. So I'll talk about an idea of going from 1D to 2D by sort of stacking one-dimensional Hubbard chains. It's an old idea. And what happens in this model is that we can essentially drive the Mach transition, the critical temperature of the Mach transition, to zero, to a quantum critical point, or marginal quantum critical point. So that's the outcome of it. So I'll start with the model and motivation. So I basically already said part of it. And of course, it's a hard problem because it's a frustrated problem. So we'll try two methods, the exact method. So these are auxiliary field Monte Carlo, where we can really solve the problem at least in the limit of weakly coupled chains. And you will see that if you solve the problem in this way, you'll get one answer, which is where the ground state is dominated by magnetism. And if you solve the problem with another method, which cluster methods like DMFT or DCA, you essentially frustrate the magnetism and you will get what you want to get, right? But you have to be careful. These are two different methods for the same model and two different answers, right? So that will be, that's how it is, right? It's a hard problem. Then I'll conclude. So this is work which has been essentially driven by Marcin Rakowski, who was a postdoc in my group, and he went to Munich, then he came back to Würzburg. And a lot of people sort of joined along the way. So Lord Pollet when he was in Munich, and then Thomas Pruschke, Benjamin Lenz, and Salvatore Manmana. These are people in Göttingen who are doing VCA calculations for this model. So let me start with the Hamiltonian. So it's very simple. These are basically one-dimensional chains. So it's a Hubbard model, right? We have T's along the chain. This is T here along the chain would be the unit. We want to add some frustration because we don't want to have nesting instabilities. So we have a T prime here, which we will peg to T perp, so as not to have too many parameters. And we put the minus here because this is sort of maximally frustrating electron motion in an antiferromagnetic background if you take the minus. And so the T perp. So we have essentially two parameters. One parameter for the band structure, this is T perp. And the other parameter is the Hubbard U. And of course, chemical potential will be tuned to keep everything at half filling. So at the onset, you can have this idea for what, this is a sketch of what you will have for the phase diagram. So again, it's at half filling. And you can start from 1D by putting T perp to zero, and then going all the way to 2D, where you have the full C4 symmetry here at T perp equals one. So if you start at one in one dimension, right, so you know that umklapp is relevant. You have no Mott transition. So here, umklapp is relevant, as I said, and you will always have a Mott transition. And then in the two-dimensional case here, you always have, basically, we know this from experiment, since we have frustration, this Fermi liquid here should be stable, at least at weak coupling. And here we have a first-order transition. It's a Mott transition with a finite temperature critical endpoint. Okay, so this is the guess of the phase diagram. So let me start with the high dimension, starting from high dimension and telling you, going from 3D to 2D and then telling you why I would like to go to 1D continuously somehow. And so you can start with 3D. These are very well-known experiments, vanadium oxides. And essentially, this is the metal insulator transition in metal oxides, in vanadium oxides. We know what the order parameter is. The order parameter should be double occupancy. It's this local scalar field. So you should have some type of Ising universality class for the transitions. And in fact, you do. If you assume that this is an assumption, I suppose. If you assume that the conductivity is the order parameter, then if you go along this coexistence line, so this is temperature, pressure, and this is the conductivity. If you go along this coexistence region of metal and insulator, then essentially if you go like this, sigma minus sigma C, sigma's critical here at this point, at endpoint, should define essentially the beta exponent. And of course, then the pressure would be like the magnetic field in the Ising terminology with an exponent 1 over delta. And D of sigma over D of P would be like the magnetic susceptibility, still in the analogy of the Ising model, and you will define the gamma exponent. So you can calculate, do experiments and look at this is what is done in this paper, and look at the mean field, at the exponents, and you see that actually over a wide range, if you're not too close to the quantum critical point or to the critical points, classical critical point, then you get a mean field exponents as you would get in DMFT. So this is, I guess, one of the big successes of DMFT, to go get those Ising exponents for the metal insulator transition. And very close to the transition, you get a crossover to the three-dimensional Ising models. The point is, what I'd like to make here is not so much these exponents, But the TC is pretty high, right? So it's at 450 Kelvin or so. So if you go to two dimensions, right? So this is now going to the two dimension. It's a two-dimensional organic, so kappa by TTF, I think. And it has also the same type of Mott transition with a critical endpoint. The critical endpoint is much lower, right? It's at it's an order of magnitude lower in temperature than for the vanadium oxides. And you can do the same type measurements, experimental measurements. So conductance, pressure, and temperature, it's rotated somehow. And you can get out the beta exponents 1 over delta and gamma. And then puzzle starts. If you get, these are the exponents you get out of the experiments. They satisfy some type of scaling relations with them, for example, here. So they claim to be maybe correct. The problem is that they don't fall at all in the 2D Ising universality class. So I don't have so much to say about it. But there's a recent paper here, a PRL of this year, saying that if you that you can reanalyze the data by assuming that sigma is not proportional to the order parameter but to the 1 over the length scale, and then they can get, for it's another compound, but they can get an interpretation of a 2D in terms of 2D Ising. So read this paper if you want to know more about this thing about exponents. My point is again that if you go from 3D, you had a TC which was 400 Kelvin, 2D you have a TC which is 39 Kelvin, and so the question is, if you go from 2D to 1D here, can you drive this TC to, is there a critical point here where the TC will go to zero? So that's the question. When you go now continuously from 2D to 1D, can we go drive the system, the transition from a classical transition with a finite TC to a quantum transition at TC equals zero? So that's it. Yes?
In which sense these systems are related to coupled chains?
Which ones?
You went from vanadium.
So that's a good question. Actually, if you look at some band structure calculations that were done by Nakamura and Imada, they're not isotropic, right? So they may be some of the organics may be somehow here, right? If you do some band structure calculations.
I was more worried about vanadium oxide, but
vanadium oxide was just starting from somewhere. Right, so 3D, I'm going to 2D, and then the 2Ds here. Maybe if you take, they're pretty soft materials, right? So they're not completely isotropic, right? I'm not saying that they're here. These are maybe more like the Beskard cells, right? So what is the nature of the? So the question is, we would like to ask. This is the motivation part of the talk still, so don't be too strict. Can I drive this transition to zero, right? And also, what is the nature of the metallic state in the vicinity of the dimensional driven metal insulator transition? So here, right? What is the nature of the metallic state here? So some more experiments. If you look at, I talked a lot about this point here in the vicinity of this point. If you want to put materials here, then you would, at least coming from the 1D, then this would be the Beskard salts, where TMTTF is an insulator and it has these type of hopping parameters. If you go to TMTSF, then this 10 goes to 25, so you have a much bigger, if you want, interchain hopping in that sense. And this is the conductivity of TMTSF, and you do have a metallic state. And this is essentially believed to be the one-dimensional Hubbard chains. Okay, so that's it. So what about magnetism? So this was just, we're just talking about the charge. Another aspect here is the magnetism. If you start with 1D, then you have spin on. So your spin 1 half sort of breaks down into spin 1 half excitation. So these are experiments on this one dimensional chain. This is neutron scattering. This is beta ansatz on just a one dimensional Heisenberg model. It's absolutely amazing how well it works. So this is a fractionalization of your spin excitations in one dimension. And of course, the question is what happens when you couple those chains. How do you get to magnons, if you get to magnons at all? This is another experiment on cuprates. You get here a beautiful spin density wave dispersion. So the question is, how do you go as a function of dimensionality to from those spin-ons to those magnons? And this is not so well known either, I think. If you don't have any frustration, then you can do large-scale Monte Carlo. This was done by Anders Sandvik back in 1999. And you, in fact, see that you have, in the absence of frustration, that the critical value of delta at which you have magnons or confinement of spin-ons is zero. When you put in frustration, I believe that it's unknown. in principle, you could have gapless spin liquids or spin liquids in those Mott phases, which will be essentially a definition of the Mott phase. Okay, so that's the
Very small difference.
Sorry?
I would disagree and say it's known for small delta.
So that even if you have frustration with frustration?
That model that you took for arbitrarily small delta, it'll be magnetically ordered.
That this one, you say?
Yes.
With no frustration?
With frustration. Your model.
Yes.
Your Hubbard model with T, T perp, T prime, for small delta.
So you say that you will have this will be how?
Be magnetically ordered there, and it'll be.
How do you know this? How do you? You just know it. And okay, that's a good answer. can you convey your can you convey? You just know it. You tell me after the talk.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. Okay. Okay, so talk to Leon to get this answer. I did not know it before the talk. So I think with frustration, okay, so maybe for small, but for large, you don't know it.
Yeah.
For large, you don't know it. Okay, so, okay. Answer that. So the methods, how do we want to solve this problem? So it's as I told you before, it's a hard problem. It has frustration, and we'll do it with two ways. We'll do some exact BSS. This is a Black and Beckler sugar Scalapino. Basically, this is a large scale Monte Carlo method, which has no approximations. You can go up to 20 by 20 lattices down to beta t equals 30, and of course the advantage is that you can calculate everything. You have all the fluctuations included in the calculation, etc. The issues is, of course, the sign problem, and that will limit us essentially to this part of the phase diagram, right? So in 1D here, we don't have any sign problem. If you couple your chains, then you can go pretty far, actually, and get to this. You won't get a Fermi liquid. I'll show you this, but you can go pretty far to coupling chains with this method. And then, but up to 2D, that won't work. That will be killed by the sign problem. So I'll first talk about the BSS approach, show you what we get, and then go to the cluster methods to show you how we can get some information on the, you know, when going more to 2D case. So these are auxiliary field Monte Carlo results, and so we're scanning like this, starting from 1D and then going scanning up the T perp. And what is plotted here is the charge susceptibility, right, as a function of temperature, and this will give us the possibility to get the charge gap. So the slope, so this is imaginary part of, well, sorry, the log of this quantity as a function of temperature. The slope here will give you the charge gap as a function of T perp over T. And you see that you have, this is the one-dimensional limit, and then if you go as a function of T perp, you have a curve with an inflection point here. So it never goes to zero. It always stays a finite number. So we would like to understand what the origin of this gap is. I don't know where does it come from. So here we know this is Umklapp. And then when you go to larger values of T perp, well, one very sensible guess is that this comes from spin density wave ordering, so just ordering, antiferromagnetic ordering. We can get this by looking at the spin correlations. So these are spin correlations at pi zero, so these are along the chains, and these are spin-spin correlations pi-pi, so the antiferromagnetic wave vector. And this is as a function of temperature for different values of T perp, right? So this is T perp equals zero here, you have pi zero, only dominant here, then at the small values of T perp, these are those red symbols. The pi zero is still dominant, the pi pi is subdominant. And when you go to larger values of T perp, well, the pi zero goes away, so this is more like the one-dimensional signature, and then the pi pi grows. At T perp equals 0.2, which are these black curves here, we can try to do some finite size scaling down to the lowest temperatures we can get, and we do get long-range of order, as Leon was saying, right? So you're right.
Yeah, I know.
You know that. Okay, good. So you're right.
You said pi zero is dominant, but it looks. If I look, the red curve is still a little larger than the red curve up there.
Well, okay. So
the axes are different, right?
Yeah, the axis is different, a bit different.
It's a little
2.5.
It's about the same.
It's about the same. Right. So you say, so
small enough T perp that fixes
for small enough T perp
be basically independent of Q Y, right?
Yes.
Which is what?
Yes. Yeah. So they so we have essentially what I'm trying to say here is that in this, at least in this region down at the temperatures, we can do the simulations. We do have some long range order here, right? Okay. So that's on the lattices we have. So one one understanding of how we can get this inflection point. And here, the origin of the gap, at least in the 1D case, would be the umklapp. The T-perp is not big enough to close it. And essentially here, what we have is a single charge gap, which comes from the antiferromagnetic fluctuations, right? So this is what we would like to get rid of with cluster methods and really go make this curve go to zero by putting in more frustration.
Excuse me.
Yes?
This is the two-dimensional isotopic, so you cannot have a finite TC for the antiferromagnetic. So how to distinguish these two regions from finite temperature regulation?
This is the charge gap, right?
I see.
So this is the charge gap. The TC is zero.
Yeah,
I agree.
And in that case, how to figure out ground state magnetization from the finite temperature?
Well, so this is what is attempted here in this inset, right? You will try to do different temperatures here. So this is a beta 10 to beta 30 here, you extrapolate to the thermodynamic limit. Now, of course, on finite systems, you can go to low enough temperatures and you will get the ground state result.
Yeah.
So if I extrapolate, so I don't really understand. So you can...
It depends how you measure MS, right?
Yeah.
So he's measuring an MS in a way which gives a non-zero result at finite temperature.
Because you have a gap, essentially, on the finite size. Sorry?
Correlation length
is bigger than the system size. And then you will go to something finite. That's that. Yep.
This, what you're calling a charge gap.
Yes.
Can I look at the definition again? Was it like a compressibility gap? Is it a compressibility?
It's the charge fluctuations, which is essentially the compressibility.
Okay. Yeah. So you're not looking at
a
single particle gap.
No, it's a two charge gap.
Yeah.
And in the absence of correlations, this would be a factor two between the two. Somehow easier to do that.
Question. On that phase diagram,
yes.
Everywhere,
yeah.
You know, beyond the single poly, the ground state is antiferromagnetic.
Yes. Yes, that's it.
Everywhere.
Not here, of course, right?
Yeah,
since you have a cheap prime which is non-zero,
yeah.
Right? And I suppose you have no nesting instability, strictly speaking, here. So you should not have antiferromagnetism at very low values of U over T. At least not in sense of an instability, right?
Okay.
But low values of U over T is extremely hard because you need extremely large lattices. So it's not an easy problem either.
So
you
have a question? What's this line?
Well, I'm trying to understand what happens to this. Where does this inflection point come from, right? And so the argument here is that when you are above this T perp of 1.5 or 0.15, for example, then really this gap here comes from the magnetization, right? From the magnetic instabilities.
You're working at some fixed U.
I'm focusing at some fixed U, which is actually here. I didn't mention that, 2.3, which is chosen so as to get the best sign problem, and the best sign, and we're just scanning it like that. Right.
So on the next slide, you had somehow crossed out FL and...
Well, for this line, at least for this line, right?
Maybe it just means you haven't located the boundary. No, there's no transition, is there?
There's no transition.
At that fixed U for T perp,
there's no transition.
Up to 0.3, there's no transition.
There's no transition. So there's no transition, right? That's all.
Would you just say, shouldn't you have drawn it just that your arrow is still within the blue region?
Yes. So this was the... So I completely agree. You're completely right. This was a sketch, right? A guess of what you would get if you could put enough frustration. So this is wrong, right? I mean, so... So I completely agree that this sketch, if you solve the problem exactly as we're doing it here, this essentially stays an insulator. There's no transition. Okay, that's it. So let me go on. If so, what we So what you can do along this line, the ground state is always an insulator, but in principle, what you can do is look at the finite temperature crossovers. So this is an attempt to look at the spin and the charge, discharge and the spin dynamical structure factors. So this is, we're taking now, this is the charge gap, which we computed just before, and looking at the dynamics by along this line at U over 2.3.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, of course, please do.
So if I just take your model to
yes.
to the quote isotropic limit where delta is one, how you define it?
Yes.
And then take U to infinity, so it's a, you know, it's a Heisenberg model.
Yes.
Do you know that Heisenberg model is in the pi ordered state, or is it some different?
So that would give me a. I have a t perp of 0.25 squared.
Right.
That's pretty small.
It's quite small.
It's quite small. So that would still be well in the magnetically ordered phase.
Nail.
In the nail phase.
Not only magnetic ordered, but specifically pi pi.
Yes, it would be a pi pi state. Right. I guess that the frustration is pretty small, and we can do the Monte Carlo. That's the cap somehow. We can do the Monte Carlo here because the frustration is small, right? If we put it much higher, then we will get one. You know, these are much. We will go into we will get into large sine problems. Further questions.
Sine of t prime, does it matter with respect to? For some reason, you mentioned that it's.
Well, if you take a single hole, right, and you put a single hole in an antiferromagnet. If you have a minus T prime, then you get much more frustration than if you put a plus T prime. That's because of
interference
effect, right?
But you are right? And so
I might have filling, but still. This was the reason we took a minus, basically. That's all, right? To try to frustrate it more. So I will never get to the second part of the talk, which is maybe the one I wanted to do. Sorry?
You have time?
Okay, I have time.
I know.
I guess I have time also then. Charge and a spin dynamical structure factor as a function of basically the T-perp. So we're starting from the one-dimensional limit. So these are there's a lot of information here, I suppose. So this is essentially the two spin-on continuum. This is the momentum along the chain. This is perpendicular to the chain, right? So there's nothing because T perp is equal to zero. This is another cut here, right, from pi pi to 0, 0, which is here. This one here from 0, 0 to 0 pi is particularly interesting for us because if you don't put any T perp, there's nothing. The weight here is zero because the total spin of the system is zero, at least at zero temperature. So we have nothing here. And this one from pi zero pi to pi pi. Okay, so this is the starting point. So this is the two-spin-on continuum. We have a charge gap, so there are no charge fluctuations up to 0.3, which would be the charge gap here. And this is essentially like the charge structure factor of free electrons that's sort of shifted, if you want, by the charge gap of 0.3. So when you switch on the inter-chain hopping, so this is a small value of T perp, which puts you at a temp. So this is a temperature scale of. So this is 0.5 is a temperature scale. So you're below the charge gap. You still see, so you still have a, so this is the charge structure factor, dynamical structure factor. So this here is defining you, that you showing you that you still are in an insulating state. So below this here, you should be able to understand at least your spin, dynamical spin structure factor in terms of spin-ons or magnons. So what is this? What this calculation is just simple linear spin wave theory for an anisotropic Heisenberg model, and we basically fitted that the best we could, right? So you see that you're generating here sort of a gap, that you have a magnon here, which in principle can decay into two spin-ons, right? And if you go up here, it can decay into particle hole excitations because we have a particle hole continuum, right? So the fact that you have long, I mean, here you have also your spin wave here, which comes here from 0, 0 to pi pi, so you have no gap, if you want, in the spin excitations.
So you seem to have charge excitations below the gap even at the lower temperature. And
the charge excitations charge, below the gap.
No, up left.
Here.
A,
yes, here.
A, picture A, yeah. So you have the tails of the, it looked like that you have linear excitations as in spin vector.
Well, they should have a curve which goes like that. Okay. They should.
Right. There's a gap there?
The gap is 0.3. The charge gap is 0.3. Oh, this is 1. So 0.5, 0.3 should be here.
So the gap between pi 0 and pi pi is, seems to be at least twice as your gap, right? Is
it pi 0 and pi pi?
No, is it pi 0 and pi pi? Left? Left?
Left?
No.
Pi 0 and pi pi.
Yeah.
This one.
So
yeah.
This gap is...
This one, it seems to be twice as this, but the 0.3 here should be obtained by extrapolating this, right? The q going to 0, and that gives you something which is below. That's okay.
I don't think it has to vanish. It's not. It's a density-density correlation function. Yep. So it doesn't create charge excitations.
Yeah.
Right?
So it's a plasma.
Yeah. Well, no. It's.
Oh, but there's
no.
No.
That's
yeah.
what it is.
This is. But this has to. This. Yeah. This has to vanish. I mean, this cannot go to zero like this. In insulating, because
it can.
You would have long wavelength charge fluctuations. So it would be a conductor.
The weight has to be small.
The weight has to be zero. The weight has to go to zero.
It's not really charge fluctuations. It's a density correlation function. So the intermediate states are.
But
still
they're related by the continuity.
But you don't have long range Coulomb.
So, yeah. if you have
your plasma is not gapped because you don't have long range Coulomb.
It's not a conductor. It's not a plasma in any case. But you have. You have neutral gapless excitations in the 1D system, right? Which are spin-ons.
Particle.
And you can make a pair of them, which carries no spin. You can also make a pair which carries spin, so the pair carrying spin contributes to the bottom one, but the pair that carries no spin, perfectly fine, and they're gapless. They can contribute, but they have a matrix element that vanishes in the q going to zero in it. You know, if you just think about the spectral representation of density-density correlation function, the intermediate states, they don't have extra charge. If I look at the electron Green's function, it actually has to vanish from moving.
It's a particle, okay.
Or the pair field correlation function.
So I'd like to make another point. So these are obtained using MaxEnt.
Sure.
So actually you should put a cutoff below which we should not be looking, and that is like 2 pi times the temperature, so it's, 6 times T. We should not be looking below that because the method is not really trustworthy there. So, all this discussion about really low frequency gaps and so on, so I don't know, so your temperature you say is
beta
less
30.
Than delta C.
Beta 20, so that's 0.05.
You should multiply by 2 pi, and that's like 6 times T. And
why do you say it's not a?
You have a discretization in your imaginary time, which is, that discretization when you translate it into frequency.
Sure, I understand that.
Will give you a cutoff.
What is this? But that's the discretization in the delta tau you're talking about.
No,
the lowest Matsubara frequency. I'm not sure. In principle, the information you don't have is the high frequency because of the delta tau. Right? That I agree. Sorry? We can discuss this later, but there are enough pitfalls for the MaxEnt, right? I can continue here. If we go and move on to 0.3, that's T perp, then this is basically at a temperature which is of the order of the charge gap. And so you see that you get here, from an insulator to you have your metallic phase here, you have a mode which with non-vanishing spectral function which goes down linearly to 0.0, so you have your charge excitations here. You have your magnon, which is here, which can now decay, I suppose, into particle hole channel. This is into the particle hole channel. Here are charge fluctuations which come in. So essentially, what I'd like to, the aim of this calculations was to show that we can essentially get these insulator to metal crossovers at finite temperature, if we go to low enough temperature and we get some ordering, we'll get essentially an insulating state, right? So that was the first part of the talk, which made okay. So that was sort of now. So we would like to go further and really, you know, try to get this type of phase diagram. And the question we have is how to frustrate the magnetism. And we can't do it with exact method, at least not with the ones we have for the moment. And the only one, the way we could do is to go to cluster method. So these are then calculations we have, which are done with cluster dynamical mean field theory at finite temperatures on various system sizes, 8x2, 2x2, 4x4, with basically Hirsch-Phi or exact normalization solvers. And we've used two methods, essentially, finite temperature CDMFT and also the variational cluster approximation, which allows us to go to zero temperature on small clusters with just a small number of BAF sites. So the advantage is, of course, is that we get essentially rid of the sign problem if we work on small enough clusters. We can frustrate the magnetism by working only with paramagnetic phases. And of course, there are enough issues also. The cluster size is too small. Real space fluctuation not taken into account. Getting dynamical two particle quantities is very hard, right? So this is a program which has also been done by Silker and other people some time ago. People on the name of Chain DMFT. Okay, so this is the methods we have, and we'd like to now start and go back and look at the phase diagram, but now start from the two-dimensional case.
Sorry.
Yes.
Are you doing a cluster of chains, or are you doing a cluster of?
So I'm for the moment a cluster of. We're doing clusters. All the results I have are pretty much independent of that. We're doing clusters of ladders, 8x2. We're going to do 4x4 and also 2x2. But we're not going to do any chain DMFT in that sense.
You're not.
We're not. Okay. So that's a difference from what has been done. We haven't done chain DMFT. I think my pointer died. That won't die. Okay.
There should be one on the desk.
Yeah, the problem is that. No more batteries.
Even the slide change.
So the slide change still works. So this is this is double occupancy, right? As a function, we're scanning in this direction like that, and for different values of t perp. So double occupancy as a function of u over t. This is at a low temperature, but at t equals 40. And you see, basically, you have your jump here, so we're giving you a first-order transition as a function of different T-perps. And at a smaller value of T-perp of 0.3 or something like this, then we seem to be losing this jump and making it sort of continuous. So at this transition, we can start to argue that this phase transition here is continuous, first-order, and the TC, as we will see later, drops down maybe to zero at a finite value of T-perp. So that was the goal of what we had at the beginning. So we can get more, these are finite temperature results. We can now go to variational cluster results. So these are 2x2 clusters with 4 BAF sites. So you're actually solving an 8-site problem. What you can calculate here at zero temperature is the jump in the double occupancy as a function of T-perp. So this is, these are the calculations which are done for each value of T-perp. You see here, what you're monitoring here is the jump. And in fact, you see that the jump sort of scales to zero at a finite value of T perp. So it's the same, essentially the same overall result as for the CDMFT. Okay? Yes?
What's your U value here?
So the U value is being scanned, right? So you're scanning the U value like this for each T perp, right? Okay. At one point you will have two solutions, right? Mm-hmm. And the two solutions have two different values of the double occupancy, and you will essentially plot the jump.
So for T perp less than this value, as a very U, what's happening? There's a transition?
Yes, there's a transition. There's a metal insulator transition. I'll show you afterward the Fermi surface.
And you claim it's continuous?
I'll show you the results. Okay? I'll show you the results.
What happens if T perp equals zero?
At T perp equals zero. At T perp equals zero, you have a. It's a two. I mean, at least from the 2x2 cluster at T perp equals zero, you should always have an insulator.
It knows that.
It knows that from the CDMFT. I mean, that's the minimal cluster where you get one cloud, right? So it does. You do get that. These were papers of Gabi Gottlieb some time ago, where you can, for the two-side DCDMFT, you get a you get the Mott transition.
So if t probably equals zero, that's just one D chain.
One D chain, exactly.
And why is, are you setting the U equals infinity, or why the double occupancy is zero?
The jump in the double occupancy,
oh, the transition.
This is the jump in the double occupancy. So what this plot is that for each value of t perp, right? I give you a t perp. You do a set of a VCA calculations, and you see, try to locate the transition where you have two solutions, right? The Mendelian-Seder transition, and then you at the point where they, you know, where it's the energy changes between the insulator to the metal case, you define the jump in the double occupancy.
How do you locate the transition actually? So there's various criteria. I mean, when people do regular DMFT, they talk about the various different critical U's. One where one solution.
So you see that these arrows continue essentially. So you have the UC1 and UC2, and the transition is where in the SFT, in the self-energy functional theory, then approximate theory of Mikhail Putov essentially. Then you can have the energy, and you look at where the energy switches, right? And that's the definition of
that's
the thermodynamic definition. Okay.
Is there a physical interpretation of this jump?
It's a first-order transition. The DMFT reproduces the Ising type of character of the Mott transition, and so it should be a first-order transition. That, I think, is okay. Right. So below TC, below the finite temperature critical endpoint, then you should have a jump in the double occupancy, which is essentially the order term. Okay. So I think that's okay. This is the result. You can also look at. So this is zero temperature. You can also look at the finite temperature results. So this is, again, switching back to CDMFT. Again, a small cluster, a 2x2 cluster. So these are essentially, as a function of temperature, the same type of calculations. So this is for a T perp 0.9, so very close to the two-dimensional limit. And high temperature, you have a smooth curve for the double occupancy. At TC, you should have some type of singularity, some non-analyticity, and then below the TC, then you should see this jump in the double occupancy, right? So here you can locate more or less TC. If you go to T perp over T0.3, then you have to go to much lower temperatures to start to locate the jump in the double occupancy, right? So you can, out of this is not as precise, I suppose, but out of this you can look at the temperature dependence, the T perp dependence of the critical temperature, and it seems to go down to zero at one critical point here. Okay, so that's consistent with the zero temperature results. So now, so this is the summary somehow of those transitions, T perp over T as a function of U. So this is not a sketch anymore. This is the Mendelian-Seder transition as seen, if you want, by the jump in the double occupancy. So this is where TC goes to zero, or the jump goes to zero. And then one question which we still have to answer, which was asked, is that what happens below the jump, for example, is it still a Mendelian-Seder transition? The answer is yes, it is. So to get this information, we look at the Fermi surface topology, and would like to answer to understand what happens in Fermi surface topology when we go up this line. So this line, 0.2, is just below, if you want, the first order. I mean, just below, it's still 0.2 is here, more or less, just below the point where T per C goes to zero. So if I start at this point here with no interactions, then essentially the one-dimensional case gives me so these chains, right? Fermi surfaces with no warping. The T perp gives me here warping, okay? And then if I look, if you do the CDMFT and or the VCA, so this is independent of the method, and you look at the Fermi surface just at this point here, so I started here, if you want, these are these blue lines. If you do the CDMFT at this point here, then what you will get is a Fermi surface which breaks into electron and hole pockets. And so one possible interpretation of this, which we have, is that essentially at these pi-half points, the warping at pi-half goes to zero, and then you could have some umklapp processes between those points which would break up the Fermi surface. So how can we see this essentially? I mean, there could be other transitions here, which could be pi-pi, magnetic fluctuations, which are here. This is a work where Basilko was involved. And essentially, these are the same type of Fermi surface breakup for a spinless fermion system where you have no magnetic fluctuations. And so you could argue that the same mechanisms which work here to break up the Fermi surface into electron and hole pockets should work up here, work here, and this should, in principle, be, I guess, umklapp between the pi-half points.
Then, the 2x2 cluster?
This is the 2x2 cluster, and I can show you some results for the 4x4 cluster and the 2x8 cluster. So it's pretty robust, right? This breakup of the Fermi surface. Is that the, yeah. So it's
I
not.
I was wondering because the 0.5 is probably the zone boundary for the.
Yes.
Zone of the 2x2
yeah.
cluster.
So I think these are problems you see on the 2x2 clusters, which you won't get. So that I agree. But the breakup, so we worked much more for the breakup of the Fermi surface. For this breakup of the Fermi surface to electron and hole pockets, this is pretty much cluster independent. Well, 2x2, 4x4, 2x8. I don't know anything else, right? Okay, so what you will also see is that the spec. So what's plotted here is this spectral function at omega equals zero, essentially. And you see you have a strong part, a very bright part, and then a shadow part, which is very small intensity. If you compare also with the spinless fermion case here, you'll see that this pocket is very symmetric. Well, it's hard to see right here because it's a very symmetric pocket. And we can interpret this as fluctuations of pi zero spin modes, but this is not very clear. So this is what the metallic state we have here, and then the phase transition. Essentially, what happens when you go up?
Is the metallic state? Would you, if I just extrapolate it to zero temperature, is it Fermi liquid? Guess. What's your interpretation?
Well. Is it a firm? It's a. If you extrapolate it down to here,
no.
Zero temperature.
This is a zero temperature calculation, VCA calculation.
It is a zero temperature calculation.
So it's a zero temperature VCA calculation, and these are poles in the Green's function. Uh-huh. All right. Now. So
about the Fermi surface volume. Wondering about Lunger's theorem.
Well, these are electrons and hole pockets, so they have to add up to zero. Compensating metal. So if you have half filling, so the volume, so the Luttinger, so the volume of this plus the volume of this should add up to minus should add up to zero.
Zero.
Yeah, well, just as many holes as electrons.
It should be one. It should have
beyond half filling. The zero is half filling.
I understand, but the actual system is half filled.
Yes,
right?
The actual system
should
is half filled.
So I should have a Fermi surface, which is half the volume of the zone.
So if this, what I will.
How do I get that from there? Another way to ask the question.
The
red curve, I understand. On
the red
left,
curve is the left curve. The red curve is essentially just a, so it's non-interacting.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's
and
trivial, right?
Occupation is one on the
occupation
left.
Occupation is one. Occupation is also one on the for this, right? I mean, if I give you this would be the spectral function, right? Right. So you don't have the whole thing, but you would have these are, I'm just. You know, it's just a compensated metal. You have one parabola here, another one there, and you just.
But a compensated metal is appropriate to a system that has an even number of electrons. So, mm-hmm.
Can I take the question afterwards?
No. Okay. Yeah.
So let me go. I'll show you the understanding of my afterwards. Okay. So perfect. So the first question is how do you go from the metal to the insulator, and so the transition here is a, so it's essentially what happens as you go along these lines, basically the volume of the hole in the electron pocket just go to zero. And it goes in a, it goes to zero in a continuous way, right? So that's the my understanding of how you go from the metal to the insulator. Then they, at finite values of, if you go beyond this this point here where you get a first order, then essentially you still have those compensated metal, electron, and hole pockets just below the transition, but you have then a jump, if you want, in the Fermi surface topology from a volume of the holes and electrons, which is a which is pretty big, to something which is as close to zero. So you can see it here, the jump basically from 49 to 51, there's a jump in the Fermi surface topology. Okay, so that's the understanding.
So,
yes?
Too many questions.
No, no, it's okay. It's okay.
So if I think about N of K.
Yes.
So I look to this plot of this ellipsoid.
Right.
So N of K is 1 or 0 or in between. How I would distribute N of K on this?
Well, N of K would be, N of K would show a, here, would show something which goes up, right, and then would go down here if you want, right, and would not be necessarily one, because the quasi-particle residue here is rather small, right? So you will not have a big jump there, right? So the jump in N of K.
The N of K can work, right? It's probably one in the middle and zero on the outside. It just doesn't have any singularities when you go through the regions between the.
Well, it has singularities when you go here, right?
Yeah, but not
the singularities which goes here are basically the quasi-particle weight, which I'm showing here. Right. Otherwise, it should be some something smooth depending on the value of u.
How do you define this ellipsoid?
Essentially, the single particle spectral function at omega equals zero. Right. So it's a Fermi surface.
Does this thing look all like this all the way down to very small u? So they take very small, small u. Maybe the calculation can't work at very small.
This
anywhere on that. Yeah.
Well, at one point you have to go. At one point you have to touch back to the red one.
I understand, but suppose I start so at u equals zero, it's the red, and now I turn a little bit of u on.
I don't know that.
Does it immediately?
I don't know. Further questions?
But this is sometimes a static spinless wave in commercial.
No, it's a paramagnetic phase.
Even down to zero temperatures.
Well, we chose it to be paramagnetic. It's the method dictated paramagnetic phase. There's no. We just switch off magnetic. Okay, so this is the jump then if you go away from beyond the first order critical point here. And then these are other simulations, though. So these are CDMFT simulations to tell you that we still have those hole pockets. So this is what I was telling you before. This is on a 4x4 lattice, and you essentially still have the same type of hole pockets on bigger lattices and also on 8x2 lattices. So then maybe back to the question what Leon was asking before about the Fermi surface, I suppose. And so what comes here is are sketches from simulations which I can show you, in which will give you an understanding of the Fermi surface in terms of the zeros and of the Green's function, zeros and poles of the Green's functions. So these are sketches for scans which go along this line here, which come from Monte Carlo simulations on 2x8. And essentially in the Mott phase around here, then you will have zeros of the Green's function, which are given by these lines. You can calculate essentially the Green's function. You can calculate exactly this object here with the CDMFT. And look at the real part and see where it vanishes. So you get some hole box, some zeros, which are here as a function in the Mott phase. Then when you go to this compensated metal phase, or these pockets, essentially what you have is the red points here are the poles of the Green's function, which essentially emerge when you cross the second order phase transitions. Those parts of the pockets which are close to the zeros. Have a small weight because the self-energy there is pretty big. Essentially what happens when you go even further, right, there is a transition which is not shown on this plot here, but there's a transition to a large Fermi surface where the poles and the zeros of the Green's function essentially meet. So this is somehow the same type of of picture which emerges from doping mod insulators by, in this paper of Sakai Motome and Masai Mata. So let me go back to your question. Does this answer your question or not? No. Yes?
Well, my question is answered, I think.
Okay.
So we can.
Okay. So that's all we have. For example, so the conclusion here is that we have an axis where we can drive this DMFT type Mott transition to zero at a finite value of T perp. And so the question is, so I have two conclusions, which are essentially one, which is the outlook, and why I think that this is interesting. So the one thing is that if you go and look at this paper, what is noted in this paper is that if you put yourself, so this is the DMFT phase diagram of the metal insulator transition. So this is the finite temperature critical endpoint, which is Ising-like, and this is the coexistence regime, right? And so if you put yourself above TC, right, then what those people here have noted is that the resistivity follows the following scaling ansatz. So delta U, this is the distance from this, what they call the Winnum line. And so experimentally, this Winnum line would be essentially the line where you have an inflection in the resistivity versus pressure, not U, right? So you would define this Winnum line this way. This is done also in experiments. I'll talk about this afterwards. So delta U is defined in this way. So for each temperature, you have a U star. Then this defines the distance from this U star. And then what they see is that the rho, the resistivity, scales as this is the resistivity on this Winnum line and a universal function, which scales as a function where T0, this energy scales as delta U to an exponent, Z mu they call it, which is 0.56. Right? So they find this. I think it's empirical as far as I understand. And they find this, of course, only above TC and claim that this is the consequence of a hidden quantum critical point, right? Thereby, that's the claim of the paper. What's pretty amazing, I think, is that there's a recent paper by Kanoda, who has looked in three different compounds, right, on the organic compounds with very different ground states. So this is a quantum spin liquid one, antiferromagnetic superconductor, here quantum spin liquid again, etc. And they found that they can essentially understand, at least collapse the experimental data to such a form here with an exponent, which seems to be pretty different or pretty similar for the three materials, right? So this is the finding of these two papers, and the interesting thing which we can do now essentially is that we have an axis at least where we can put in this TC going to arbitrarily low temperature, and at least check this size scaling, this ansatz as a function of temperature, to see if it really survives if you go down to lower temperatures when you put in TC. So that's the outlook of this work. So let me now conclude with the summary. So we have we've looked at this model, which I think is very rich, and we have essentially two ways of doing the calculations. One is with cluster methods, and within those cluster methods, I've shown you that we get this type of phase diagram. There's a finite temperature critical TC here, which goes down to zero at a finite value of T perp. We can understand the Fermi surface topologies and the metal insulator transitions, etc. And of course, you have to this is a cluster result in the sense that if we try to do the same thing in this region here with exact BSS methods, then essentially what happens is that the whole thing gets masked by magnetism, essentially. So, further questions? That's it. Thank you very much.
Greg?
Yeah, so what can trust, like in the small T perp region?
That's a good question. What do I trust? Well, I trust the lattice methods, of course, right? And the hope somehow is that you can put in enough frustration to at least see this physics which you get from the cluster methods at finite temperature, right? That's the hope, right? But this has to be shown still. This is not trivial. To try to reproduce this physics you see here by cluster methods at higher temperatures this is a highly non-trivial. This is highly non-trivial. I haven't been able to do that for a while.
Yeah.
Yes.
How hard is it to put the magnetism at a mean field level back in the cluster method?
It's very easy. It's very easy. We don't want. Yes, we did not want to do that.
We did not want
to. We did not want to do that. We wanted to.
It will obliterate.
Sorry. Yep.
You expect it will.
It will. It will just wash out everything. I mean, I mean, if you're ready to get it you're ready to get it in those methods where you allow for fluctuations, if you don't allow for fluctuations, it will be even more robust.
Still allow for fluctuations within the cluster.
It's a 2x2 cluster.
What about this 8x2?
Yeah, this is possible. We haven't done this. That's possible. We haven't done this. We wanted to look at the paramagnetic points for the moment.
Yep, yeah, correct. So I'm still trying to ask you about the jump of the double alkalinity.
Sure.
You mentioned this jump because it's acting as an autoparameter and there's this transition. But in my mind, I'm thinking like the autoparameter for the transition from Mollin insulator to the Fermi liquid, usually people talk about it's the jump of the quasi-particle weight, right? So I can understand that, but I don't.
Well, there's strictly speaking no order parameter, right?
Yeah, because you explained to me that there's
the depth. Sorry, yes.
I'm saying I asked you a question why there's a jump. You explained to me that the W alkalinity acting as an order parameter. But in my mind, the order parameter seems to mean that
it's a scalar. The double occupancy acts as the scalar field.
Any quantity like that doesn't break any symmetry.
We'll show such an Ising transition.
You can show it more directly because he's just varying u crossing that boundary. So first order transition means you have a kink in the ground state energy as a function of u, which is exactly, if you take the derivative with respect to u, that's the double occupancy.
That's it.
There you go.
If you look at if you do calculate the ground state energy with this method, you will get a level crossing.
Have you tried the final size scaling analysis? Like try to see how it depends on the size of the system?
No, it's a first order transition, and it's at TC, I suppose, if you do DMFT, you will get some mean field type exponents. And then if you do some finite size scaling and you stay in a 2D case, you will at one point go to the 2D Ising exponents. Right? So, but that hasn't been, that's not done. Yeah?
So I guess it's a follow-up to one of the questions by Leon. So if you put in magnetic order.
Right.
Just calculate the ground state energy. Is there a meaningful way of comparing this ground state energy with the ground state energy of this the cluster when you didn't impose and you just decide which one is lower?
So you would like to impose mean in the DCA or in
try
the
try different ground states and see which one gives you the lower energy. Is it possible in this DMFT?
Of course.
So why would that be a bad strategy?
It's not a bad strategy. It's just a question of choice of what you want to. I mean, the idea really of this set of calculations. Let me answer this. Try to this a bit better. What we want to do. Why did we use the cluster methods? We use the cluster methods because we would like to, find ways to frustrate the magnetism and see what happens if we don't have the magnetism. That's the idea behind using those cluster methods. So why would I put it back in? Right? That's why we didn't do it. But in principle, you can do it, and you will most probably find a ground state energy which is lower if you allow for magnetism than if you don't allow for it.
I guess I was mistaken then on your goal. I thought the goal was to find the two-phase diagram of this model, and you are different goals.
So the That's a good question. And like all these cluster methods, I think they maybe it's a very tough question for people who go in cluster methods, because you, So the goal is to find the true phase diagram if you allow you don't allow for magnetic instability.
So it that, may be that you maybe, just have the wrong model
that,
then, right?
Sorry?
It may just be that you have the wrong model. You want a model that really does not have.
So the hope is that to have enough frustration, as I said before, to be able to get the nail temperature, to get the ordering very low.
But some people do put the magnetism in, right?
Of course, that's no problem. That's no issue. That's no issue. So if you can find a you could, in principle, put in the magnetism and try to do finite temperature and see, you know, if you can get those finite temperature transitions before the magnetism kicks in.
But just to make sure I understand, so you basically want a model which, in the strong coupling limit, is a spin like a quantum spin.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah.
And then you want to simulate that.
That's a bit tough. Yeah.
But with a cluster method, you can do that. There, you can just take your T prime larger and move yourself into the, you know, that window of J whatever in the 2D full 2D limit. You would have J not even deformed J1 J2 model, and you know where the window is, where there is no magnetic order.
Yeah, but the cluster methods won't get the spin liquid type things, right? They will just get a solid, right? I mean, they won't get the. I mean, you break this. It's just the dimerization of your two-dimensional lattice. So these are questions which are far beyond the cluster methods, I think.
So TC is defined as in an insulated ground state. Right? So
TC is defined as insulating with respect to an insulating ground state. Yes.
So if I think about the TC on this phase diagram,
right.
So it's zero. Is the green region?
It's no. So the TC is only defined on this line. We have the transition, right?
So if I am in a MOT state,
if you are in the MOT state, then you have no TC. You have a TC at the. So let me show you the experimental part. Right. This is a nice plot. So the vanadium oxide, where you have TC, right?
So in ritual 3, you know, in ambient pressure.
Anywhere it's an insulator.
Anywhere it's an insulator. Well,
no, for some reason.
So here's a metal, right? With an insulator, and that's the region where you have the TC is where the. That's where the TC is. Right? At the end of this. That's the TC, and essentially what we're looking at, this is, so what this is, so we have for, you know, so this is, so in this plot here, this would be the TC, which just corresponds to one point here, and then we're following this TC by, you know, changing some model parameters. That's what's happening.
Okay, sure, maybe you have mentioned this, but I missed that. So are you aware of any study using like personalization treating the 1D chain and also the infills, like perturbations here treating the coupling?
Yes, that's Esler and Svelli.
And are the results consistent? Are the results consistent? With
yes, they see also those, they also see this compensated metal and those pockets, right? So that's the result of their calculations. That has been done with organization from Nesma and Svelte. Should have mentioned that. Yes.
Okay, please look for the question.